For this reason, I have sent to you Timothy, who is my beloved and faithful child in the Lord, who will remind you of my ways which are in Christ Jesus. Consider this, I urge, the noble soul, the soul more radiant and sharp than fire, how he was particularly eager to be present himself with the Corinthians, who were unwell and divided into factions. For he understood the significant help his presence provided to the disciples and the harm his absence caused. He explained the former in the epistle to the Philippians, saying, "Not only as in my presence, but now even more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." The latter he indicates in this epistle, saying, "Now some are arrogant, thinking I will not come to you, but I will." It seems he was impatient and eager to be present himself. Since this was not feasible for a while, he corrects them with his promise to appear, and not only this, but also by sending his disciple. "It's for this," he says, "I have sent Timothy to you." For this reason, what does that mean? "Because I care for you like children, as ones I have begotten." His message even comes with a commendation of his own person. "Who is my beloved and faithful child in the Lord?" This he said both to express his love for him and to prepare them to receive him with respect. And he is not just faithful, but faithful in the Lord. That is, faithful in things pertaining to the Lord. And if in worldly matters it's high praise for a man to be faithful, it's even more so in spiritual matters. If he was indeed his beloved child, consider how vast Paul's love was, choosing to be apart from him for the sake of the Corinthians. And if he was also faithful, he will be impeccable in managing their issues. "Who will remind you?" He didn't say, "will teach," in case they took offense, being used to learn from him. Therefore, he also says towards the end, "For he does the work of the Lord, just as I do. So, no one should despise him." The apostles did not harbor envy. Rather, they focused on one thing, the building up of the church. If the person who was tasked was their junior, they enthusiastically supported him. That's why he wasn't just content with saying, "He will remind you," but sought to eliminate their envy even more. Since Timothy was young, he added, "My ways, not his, but mine," meaning his tactics, his perils, his traditions, his laws, his ordinances, his apostolic canons, and everything else. Since he had said, "We are exposed and buffeted, without a steady place to stay," he will remind you of all these things, as well as Christ's laws, for the purpose of demolishing all heresies. Then, elevating his argument, he adds, "which are in Christ," attributing everything as usual to the Lord, thus validating what is to follow. Hence, he says, "just as I teach everywhere in every church." "I have told you nothing new. All the other churches are aware of these proceedings just like you." Furthermore, he refers to them as ways in Christ, indicating that they don't possess anything human, and that with assistance from that source, he accomplishes all things well. After saying these things and thus calming them, and about to point out the guilt of the immoral person, he speaks with words full of anger again, not because he felt so, but with the intention of correcting them. And instead of focusing on the immoral person, he converses with the others as if he didn't even think the immoral individual was worth his words, just like we do with our servants when they have greatly upset us. Next, after he had said, "I send Timothy so they wouldn't take things too lightly," pay attention to what he says. But 18. "Now some are becoming arrogant as if I were not coming to you." Here he subtly points at both them and certain others, bringing down their arrogance, as the love of superiority is at fault when people misuse the absence of their teacher for their own stubbornness. Notice when he speaks to the citizens, how he does so by appealing to their conscience. When he addresses the instigators of the trouble, his approach is more forceful. So to the former he states, "We are the refuse of all," and comforting them he asserts, "I am not writing these things to shame you." But to the latter, "Now as if I were not coming to you, some are becoming arrogant," indicating that their stubbornness suggested an immature mindset. For just like boys who become more careless in the absence of their master, this then is one thing clearly stated, and another is that his presence was enough for their correction. For just as the presence of a lion causes all living creatures to pull back, so does that of Paul for those corrupting the church. And so he continues, "But I will come to you soon, if the Lord is willing." Now saying this alone could seem like a mere threat, but promising himself and demanding the necessary proof through actions as well, This is a trait of a truly noble spirit. As such, he added this too, saying, "And I will understand not the words of those who are arrogant, but their power. For it's not from any of their own virtues, but from the absence of their teacher that this self-will emerged. This again was a sign of their contemptuous attitude towards him. And this is why, having said, 'I've sent Timothy,' he didn't immediately add, 'I will come,' but waited until he had accused them of being arrogant. Only then he says, 'I will come.' If he had said this before accusing them, it would have sounded more like an excuse for himself, as if he hadn't been negligent rather than a warning. Besides, the claim might not have been convincing. But by saying it after the accusation, he positioned himself in a way they would both believe and fear. Also notice how sure and safe he makes his intentions, for he doesn't just say, 'I will come,' but 'if the Lord wills,' and he sets no specific date. Considering he might possibly be late in coming, he uses that uncertainty to maintain their anxious involvement, and to prevent them from losing faith again, he adds, 'Shortly, and I will understand not the words of those full of pride, but the power.' He didn't say, 'I will understand not the wisdom nor the signs,' but what? Not the words. By using this term, he simultaneously belittles one and praises the other. For a while, he's opposing the majority of them who were supporting the sinner. For if he were talking about him, he wouldn't say the power, but the deeds, the corrupt deeds that he did. Now, why aren't you seeking after the word? Not because I lack in word, but because all our actions are in power. Just as in war, victory isn't for those who talk a lot, but those who act effectively. So also in this case, not speakers, but doers have the victory. 'You,' he says, 'are proud of your eloquence.' Well, if this were a competition and a time for orators, it would be reasonable for you to revel in it. But if it is about apostles preaching truth and confirming the same through signs, why do you boast about something excessive and illusory, and to the current purpose completely ineffective? For how could a display of words help in raising the dead, or driving out evil spirits, or performing any other such miraculous deed? However, these are what we need now, and by these our cause stands." That's why he also adds, verse 20, "For the kingdom of God is not in words, but in power. By signs, he says, not by eloquent speeches, we have prevailed, and that our teaching is divine and truly proclaims the kingdom of heaven. We provide greater proof, specifically, our signs which we conduct by the power of the Spirit." If those who are now arrogant aspire to be someone significant, as soon as I arrive, let them demonstrate whether they possess any such power. And let me not find them hiding behind a grandeur of words, for that kind of display means nothing to us.
Verse 21. "What do you want? Should I come to you with a rod, or in love and a spirit of meekness?" There is much that is both frightening and gentle in this statement. Saying, "I will know," is the speech of someone still holding back. But saying, "What do you want? Must I come to you with a rod?" are the words of someone now taking the teacher's position, and from there speaking with them and assuming all his authority. What does "with a rod" mean? With punishment, with vengeance, that is, I will destroy, I will strike with blindness, just like Peter did with Sapphira, and himself with Elymas the sorcerer. From now on, he no longer speaks as if comparing himself to other teachers, but with authority. And in the second letter, too, he seems to say the same when he writes, "Since you seek proof of Christ speaking in me, should I come with a rod or in love?" What next? To come with a rod, wasn't it an example of love? Definitely it was love. But because he retreats from punishing due to his immense love, that is how he expresses himself. Furthermore, when he talked about punishment, he didn't say in a spirit of meekness, but rather with a rod, yet even this was guided by the Spirit. There is a spirit of meekness and a spirit of severity. However, he doesn't choose to name it like that, but from its gentler aspect. Similarly, God, despite seeking vengeance, is often characterized as being gracious and patient and rich in mercy and compassion, but his readiness to punish is noted infrequently and sparingly, and that only for some pressing reason. Consider then the wisdom of Paul. Holding the authority in his own hands, he leaves both his and that in the power of others, saying, "What do you want? The matter is at your disposal." For we too face both possibilities.
both falling into hell and achieving the kingdom as God has intended. For he says, "Look, fire and water, whichever you choose, you may reach out your hand. And if you are willing and listen to me, you shall enjoy the good of the land. But if you are not willing, the sword shall consume you." But perhaps one might say, "I am willing, but wanting is not enough for me." No, but it is enough if you are effectively willing and perform the actions of one who wants. But as it stands, you are not truly willing. And let us attempt this in other areas if it seems appropriate. Consider this. The man who desires to marry, is it enough for him to simply wish for a wife? Certainly not. He actively seeks out potential partners, asks friends to keep an eye out, and gathers funds. Similarly, a business person doesn't merely sit at home wishing, but firstly hires a ship, then recruits sailors and rowers, then borrows money with interest, and shows keen interest in the market and the price of goods. Isn't it peculiar, then, that people are so serious about worldly matters, but when it comes to striving for heaven, they are content with only wishing? In fact, I would say, they aren't even properly committed in this respect, because someone who truly wills something will also take the necessary steps to achieve that which they desire. So, when hunger drives you to eat, you don't wait for the food to come to you of its own will, but you spare no effort in gathering food. You act the same way when thirst, cold, and other discomforts force you to take care of your body. Apply that same effort towards God's kingdom as well, and you will surely attain it. For this purpose, God made you a free agent, so that you might not later blame God as if some necessity had bound you. But you, in light of those very things where you have been honored, do grumble. Indeed, I have often heard people ask, "But why did he make my goodness depend on me?" No. But how was he supposed to elevate you, dormant and infatuated with all types of wickedness, living luxuriously and indulging yourself? How was he supposed to bring you up to heaven? If he had, you would not have abstained from vice. For if now, even in the face of threat, you do not refrain from your wickedness, had he made heaven the reward of your race, when would you have stopped being more indifferent and growing worse by far? Again, you won't be able to claim, "He has indeed shown me what things were good, but provided no help, for his promise of aid to you is also abundant." But, you say, "Virtue is challenging and unpleasant, while with vice great pleasure is mixed, and the one is wide and broad, but the other narrow and limited." Tell me, are they consistently so, or only at the start? Because what you're saying here, although you may not mean it, advocates for virtue. Such is the power of truth. Imagine there were two paths, one leading to a furnace and the other to paradise. One path to the furnace is wide, while the path to paradise is narrow. Which path would you prefer? For even if you argue otherwise for the sake of disagreement, you cannot deny universally accepted truths, no matter how audacious. Now it is more appropriate to choose the path which starts challenging but ends more pleasantly, and I will strive to teach you this using clear examples. Do consider, for instance, various professions. These start with hard work but end in gain. But you might counter, nobody takes on a profession without some force, for as long as a child has autonomy, they would prefer to laze around initially and endure any resulting ill later, no matter how great, rather than struggle at first and enjoy the rewards of their efforts later. Choosing such a path, however, reveals a mind left to its own devices, and a tendency towards childish lethargy. The reverse path signifies wisdom and maturity. So it's the same with us. If we weren't childish in understanding, we wouldn't imitate a carefree, thoughtless child, but rather one who has a guiding figure. Therefore, we need to let go of our childish thinking and not criticize the reality of the situation. We need a guide for our conscience that won't let us succumb to our desires, but force us to compete and struggle hard. It's downright ridiculous to initially subject our children to hardship in pursuits that begin with laborious beginnings but end well, while we do the exact opposite when it comes to spiritual matters. And yet, even in these earthly matters, it's not certain that the outcome will be good and pleasant, since untimely death, poverty, false accusations, reversal of fortune, or many other such things have previously deprived individuals of all the fruits of their long labor. Moreover, those who pursue such things, even if they succeed, are not going to gain much. for all these things dissolve with the present life. But our race is not for such fleeting and perishable things, nor do we worry about the end. Our hope beyond this life is greater and more secure. So what forgiveness can there be? What excuse for those who are not ready to endure hardships for the sake of virtue? And do they still ask, why is the path narrow? Well, you don't consider it appropriate for any fornicator or lewd or drunken person to enter the courts of earthy kings. And yet, do you expect people to be allowed into heaven itself with licentiousness, luxury, drunkenness, and covetousness, and all sorts of sin? And how can these things be forgivable? No, you might reply, I'm not saying that, but why doesn't virtue have an easy way? In fact, if we are willing, its path is really simple. So tell me, what's easier? Is it easier to break through a wall and take other people's belongings only to end up in jail, or to be satisfied with what you have and live devoid of fear? And that's not all. What's easier, to selfishly rob everyone of their possessions and enjoy only a few of them for a brief time, than to suffer and be flogged forever, or to have lived in righteous poverty for a little while and then live in never-ending pleasure? Is it more pleasant to have a pleasing dream and then be punished in reality, or to have a disturbing dream and then truly be in joy? Obviously, it's the latter. So tell me, in what way do you call virtue harsh? I agree, it seems tough if compared to our laziness. However, to understand that it's actually easy and effortless, listen to Christ's words in, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." If you don't recognize this simplicity, clearly it's due to lack of keen enthusiasm. As when there is enthusiasm, even the heaviest things become light, and without it, even the lightest things become heavy. Tell me, what could be more pleasant and easily available than the feast of manna? Yet the Jews were not satisfied, despite enjoying such exquisite food. What could be more harsh than the hunger and every other hardship which Paul had to suffer? Yet he rejoiced, jumped for joy, and stated, "Now I rejoice in my sufferings." What's the reason for this? The varied mentalities. If you shape your mind the way it is meant to be, you will discover the simplicity of virtue. What then, you ask, is she only such through the perception of those who pursue her? She is such, not from their perception alone, but by nature as well. Here's my rationale. If one path had been entirely painful, while the other completely the opposite, then it would somewhat plausible for some people to say that the latter was easier than the former. But if both paths begin, one in hardship, the other in pleasure, but their respective endings differ greatly, with one ending in infinite pleasure and the other in infinite burden, tell me, which is the easier choice? Why then do many not choose the easier path? Because some don't believe, and others who do believe have their judgment corrupted and prefer temporary pleasure over what is everlasting. Isn't this then easy? Not exactly, but this stems from a sick soul. Just as people with a fever crave a cool drink, not because they've calculated that the brief relief is better than being scorched from beginning to end, but because they can't control their intense desire. The same applies to these people, because if their punishment was enacted at the very moment of their pleasure, they certainly would never have chosen it. Thus, you see in what sense sin is not an easy thing. But if you're willing, let's test this same point again with a relevant example. Tell me, for instance, which is more satisfying and simpler? Which, I repeat, offers more comfort? Tell me, to desire large amounts of wealth or to be freed from that desire? For I personally believe the latter. If you don't trust it, let's examine the actual facts themselves. Let's then imagine one person desiring a lot, another wanting nothing. Which state is better, do you think, and which is more admirable? We can overlook this question for now. It's already agreed that the latter is a more commendable individual than the former. But we're not discussing that currently, but rather who lives a more relaxed and enjoyable life. Of course, the money lover won't even appreciate what he has, the things he loves. He'd prefer not to spend. He'd rather heal off his own flesh than part with his gold. But the person who dismisses wealth gains this, that he quietly enjoys what he has with great security, and that he values himself higher than his wealth. So, which life is more enjoyable, to freely enjoy what one has, or to live under the control of wealth, and not dare to touch even one's own possessions? To me, it seems quite similar to a situation where two men, both deeply in love with their wives, but on different terms with them. One enjoys the company and intimacy of his wife, while the other is not even allowed to approach his.
There's another aspect I want to discuss, illustrating the satisfaction of one party and discomfort of the other. A person who is greedy for wealth will never be content in their desire, not just because it is impossible for them to acquire all the wealth in the world, but because no matter how much they amass, they never feel it is enough. On the other hand, someone who disregards wealth considers it all unnecessary and doesn't punish their soul with insatiable desires. And indeed, I refer to this as punishment, since there's nothing that fits the idea of punishment more than desire without gratification, a condition which particularly characterizes this twisted thought process. Consider it this way. A person who craves wealth and has grown their wealth is the same person who feels as if they have nothing. So I ask, isn't this mental state highly complex? What's even more bizarre is that despite possessing wealth, they imagine they lack the exact wealth in their possession, and despite having wealth, they mourn for themselves. If they somehow amass the wealth of everyone, their pain only intensifies. If they acquire 100 talents, they're irked that they didn't receive 1,000, and upon receiving 1,000, they're upset it's not 10,000. If they receive 10,000, they grieve deeply because it's not 100,000. The more wealth they gain, the poorer they feel. The more they receive, the more they covet. Hence, the more they acquire, the poorer they become, since a person who yearns for more is poorer indeed. When they have 100 talents, aren't they desperately poor for desiring 1,000? Upon obtaining 1,000, their poverty deepens since they now aspire for 10,000. If you argue that to desire and not achieve is a form of pleasure, then it seems to me that you are profoundly misunderstanding the concept of pleasure. To demonstrate that this type of situation is not pleasure but rather punishment, consider another example, and let's analyze it. When we're thirsty, don't we feel pleasure in drinking because it satisfies our thirst? Isn't it pleasurable to drink because it relieves us from the extreme discomfort that is the desire to drink? I assume everyone can attest to this, but if we were to constantly remain in such a state of desire, we would be as unfortunate as the rich man in the parable of Lazarus in terms of punishment, for his punishment was exactly that, intensely desiring a single little drop, but not receiving it. And in my opinion, all greedy individuals seem to continually endure this, and comparable to him where he pleads to receive that drop but doesn't get it, for their soul is more inflamed than his. Indeed, it has been well said that all lovers of money suffer from a sort of dropsy, just as those carrying too much water in their bodies feel even more dehydrated, those who are covetous, despite having great wealth, still crave more. The reason is that neither group manages to maintain balance. Those with dropsy do not keep the water in the right parts of their bodies, and the greedy do not keep their desires within the bounds of sensible thought. Let us then escape this strange and empty disease. Let us escape the root of all evils. Let us escape this present hell, for it is a hell, the desire for these things. Just reveal the soul of each, of him who disregards wealth and of him who does not, and you will see that one is like the unstable, choosing neither to hear nor see anything, the other like a peaceful harbor, and he is a friend to all, as the other is an enemy. Whether someone takes anything from him, it doesn't bother him, or if someone gives him something, it doesn't inflate his ego. But there is a certain freedom about him with total security. The one is pressured to flatter and pretend before everyone, the other to no one. If now being fond of money means to be both poor and fearful, a deceiver and a hypocrite, filled with fears and severe punishment and chastisement, while the one who despises wealth experiences all the opposite pleasures, isn't it quite clear that virtue is the more enjoyable? Now we could have explored all the other evils as well to demonstrate that no vice derives pleasure, had we not already discussed so extensively before. Therefore, knowing these things, let us choose virtue, so that we may both enjoy such pleasure as is here, and may achieve the blessings which are to come through the grace and loving kindness, etc., etc.